This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hi, I'm Carly Warner. I'd like to acknowledge the people of the Kulin Nation whose land we gather on this evening. I pay my respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and also thank their ancestors for keeping me safe and my time on the lands of the Kulin Nation throughout my journey. I'm a Palawa woman. My mother is from southeast Tasmania, and I was born close to Wurundjeri in northeast Victoria, which is where my dad's from. I grew up travelling back and forth between southern Tasmania and northeast Victoria, and I was very fortunate to have this experience. I'm thrilled to work with the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services as their executive officer. The NATSLs are the representative body for the 8 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services across the country. And it was established as a peak body in 2007, initially operating as a body to share best practice in the provision of legal assistance services to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but over time has evolved and grown into a highly coordinated body that expanded its sphere of influence to include broader issues in addition to those of service provision. So we advocate at the national level for the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples within the justice system and work to ensure that our people have equitable access to justice. We're a member of Change the Record, and you would have seen the signs on the way in. Tonight's panel discussion is a collaboration between the Wheeler Centre and the Change the Record Coalition. And it was originally timed to flow following the report of the Northern Territory Royal Commission to the Protection and Detention of Children and to discuss the recommendations and the next steps. As most of you will be aware, the Royal Commission reporting date has now been pushed back until November, but we're still going to make the most of this opportunity. Before we delve into the topic and introduce our panellists, just briefly introduce you to Change the Record. They're an unprecedented coalition of leading Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander human rights, legal and community organisations calling for urgent and coordinated national action to close the gap in the imprisonment rates of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and to cut the disproportionate rates of violence experienced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, particularly women and children. As we move into our topic, and I'll introduce the three panellists to my left, let's set the scene. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children make up less than 6% of our young people between 10 to 17 years, but they're 55% of children in prison. Whilst imprisoned, Indigenous children have been abused in cruel and inhuman ways, including by being hooded, gassed, held in solitary confinement, inappropriately restrained, denied food and medication, and subject to forced strip searches. This continuing abuse is evidence of a need for a different approach, focusing on holistic Indigenous-led solutions and eliminating discrimination to make sure detention is a last resort. Many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and organisations have developed ways forward, and we're fortunate tonight to have three exceptional individuals on this panel to share in the discussion and in their expertise. I'd first like to introduce you to Antoinette Braybrook. Antoinette is an Aboriginal woman who was born in Victoria on Wurundjeri country. Antoinette's grandfather and mother's line is through the Cookiyalanji from North Queensland. Antoinette is the CEO of the Family Violence Prevention Legal Service in Victoria. And FVPLS Victoria celebrates 15 years of operation this year, which is a credit to Antoinette and her team. Antoinette is also the chair of the National Family Violence Prevention Legal Services Forum and the co-chair of the Change the Record Coalition. Antoinette graduated with a Bachelor of Laws from Deakin University in 2000 and was admitted as a legal practitioner in Victoria in 2004. Can we welcome Antoinette to the panel, please? Next up, Eddie Cubillo. Eddie's mother is a Larrakia, Whadjuk'un descent, and his father is from Central Arrernte. Eddie is currently completing a PhD with UTS and is formerly the Executive Officer of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services, the role that I currently sit in. Eddie is also formerly the Chair of the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency, NAJA, and the former Northern Territory Anti-Discrimination Commissioner. Eddie's most recent role has been working with the NT Royal Commission, and I'd like you to welcome Eddie to our panel. Last but not least, Shalina Musk. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Shalina. She is a descendant from the Larrakia people of Darwin. She's worked as a Crown Prosecutor in both the Northern Territory and in Western Australia. She's worked with the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia and the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency for over a decade, and she was instrumental in the creation of the youth team at NAJA. In 2015, Shalina was jointly awarded the Fitzgerald Youth Award for her innovative and holistic approaches to working with Aboriginal young people involved in the criminal justice system. Shalina has been most recently a senior lawyer with the Human Rights Law Centre since February 2017. Please welcome Shalina. So we're going to delve right in, and I apologise in advance for my croaky voice. I've been trying to preserve it all day, but I'm sure there's a wealth of expertise that'll be able to back me up if something happens to my voice. So we're going to focus this panel discussion in two parts. We're going to have two broad themes for tonight, and we're going to drill down into those two themes with some specific questions for each of our panellists. The first section is going to focus on what's currently happening in youth justice. Why do we have such high imprisonment rates of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people? The second theme is, well, where to? What can we do about it? All right, let's get straight into it. Shalina, I might start with you if I can. You've obviously got a wealth of experience working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people in your roles in Western Australia, in the Northern Territory, and now in the Human Rights Law Centre. What is it that you've seen is contributing to the high rates of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people being imprisoned?
I'll start off just based on my experience in the Northern Territory. So being a prosecutor and also a defence lawyer, and more recently for the last 5 years working as a youth lawyer in the NAJA youth team, I really understood the youth justice system in the Northern Territory to be ineffective and really ill-equipped to actually respond to young people who are coming into contact with the system. And that's due to a combination of factors. Primarily in the Northern Territory, the system is very much a reflection of the adult criminal justice system. And what I mean by that is the key institutions, the key players, and I'm talking police, lawyers, judges, all the key players are involved in the system. The processes and practices are very much a reflection of the adult criminal justice system. The key players, the institutions, treat children just like adults, and that's the problem with it. It's fundamentally wrong and it's counterproductive. There's also, I guess, a real need to understand the marked difference of children from adults. So children are not just physically different, but they're emotionally and mentally different. Their brains are undergoing significant changes in these developmental years. So just as an example, the parts responsible for consequential thinking, risk assessment, managing emotions, controlling impulses, that part of their brains are just not developed and won't be developed until their 20s. So children are going to act impulsively, they're risk averse, they're going to make mistakes, and they just won't think through the consequence of their actions. So if you start with that as the premise of a system, you're going to be more effective in your responses. But the NT doesn't quite do it that way. So treating children like adults has led to the mistakes that we've seen played out in the Four Corners episode around Don Dale. You can see that they treat them like adults. We've got children in Berrima Prison, which used to be an adult prison, and you're seeing guards who have worked in the adult system operating in the system. And the same sort of practices, the use of restraints, the use of force as a way of trying to control behaviour, not really understanding that these children are really acting out in a response to triggers. If you were working in a trauma-informed environment, you would understand what the triggers are and what this sort of behaviour is responsive to. So the system is really geared to responding to little adults as opposed to children. There's also in the NT inappropriate and ineffective laws. As an example, the Bail Act in the Northern Territory does not have youth-specific provisions, so there are no pro-bail provisions in there for young people like they do in other jurisdictions. There's also overzealous policing practices. So the same cops who are, same police officers who are involved in policing adults alleged to have been involved in offending are also the same ones who are dealing with young people, and they treat them like little adults. There's an absence of bail support programs. Nowhere in the Northern Territory are there any bail support programs like we have in other jurisdictions, and there are no youth-supported accommodation. So a young person who may have unstable living arrangements, may have trouble at home, has nowhere to go. And a lot of children that I dealt with were being simply remanded in custody, locked up. There's a lack of culturally safe and appropriate drug and alcohol programs. Bushmob, which some of you may be aware of, is probably the only one I know of in the Northern Territory. And that's over capacity and underfunded, but it does a great job. But there's nowhere throughout the rest of the territory any of the sort of programs that children need. And there's no healing programs that are able to meet the needs of children, especially Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in the Northern Territory. And the system is very much geared to being punitive. So, as you saw with Don Dale, it's a punitive system, locking them up. So that's really what I see is just an overview. There's other things which I can talk about, but even the remand rates, 71% of children in the Northern Territory are on remand. So they haven't been found guilty, they haven't been sentenced as a result of offences that they've said they're guilty for, they're on remand. So there's something seriously wrong with that, and that to me reflects a system that's really much geared to locking kids up rather than addressing the causal factors, the reasons why they offend in the first place. And again, it goes to understand the drivers of young offending, you'll be able to be more responsive and you're going to be able to meet their needs, and that's what's wrong with the system as I see it.
Yeah, thanks, Shalina. Antoinette, Shalina's mentioned that there is a connection between the youth justice systems and the adult systems, and the way that young people are treated is often a reflection of how our adults are being treated throughout all of the justice systems. I'm interested in your view about whether you think there's a connection, and do you see a broader impact on families and communities from the over-imprisonment of our young people?
Sure. I guess that it's really important to say up front that this is a national issue. It's not isolated to just the Northern Territory. And the evidence does show very clearly that strong link between youth detention and adult imprisonment. The statistics are appalling. 86% of adults in prison have been in the youth justice system, compared to 75% of other non-Aboriginal people. And young people in the child protection system are 23 times as likely to be in youth justice supervision. And our children are three times as likely to be removed from their families if a parent is or has been incarcerated. And clearly locking up our kids removes them from their communities and their families, and it disconnects them from their culture and identity, which has a devastating impact. That pathway from youth detention straight through to adult prison is very, very clear, and it shows a clear failure of the system. It's a pathway and it's a revolving door. So it's hard to understand what the system is trying to achieve when you think about it in that way. And then that just contributes to poor health outcomes for our people, poverty, homelessness, And, you know, let's not forget prisons are unsafe and they're really violent places and children don't belong in prisons.
Antoinette, I might stay with you, and particularly given the expertise that you have in family violence prevention, how is family violence contributing to the overrepresentation of our young people?
Yep, so in Victoria, 90% of Aboriginal children are removed by child protection and placed in out-of-home care because of family violence. And child protection involvement leads to youth justice involvement. There's a clear link there. Youth justice involvement, as I've just talked about, leads to adult incarceration. And, you know, what we see constantly in the work that we do at the Aboriginal Family Violence Prevention and Legal Service, especially with mums who are experiencing family violence, is the punitive approaches that child protection take when it comes to our women and holding them responsible for failing to protect their children and support, and they don't support the women to keep them safe. So, you know, we see so many children, Aboriginal children, removed unnecessarily. And I say unnecessarily because, you know, we work with many women and have so many children returned back to their families. And, you know, those removals are preventable. All that needs to happen is support for mum. That again tells us a lot about how the system continues to fail Aboriginal people, and especially Aboriginal women who experience family violence at vastly disproportionate rates. We also see children being denied their Aboriginality once they're caught up in the child protection system. We've known of situations where a child's Aboriginality has been deleted from a computer, and many of our kids in out-of-home care, they're supposed to have cultural plans, and many don't, but where there is a cultural plan, they're often inadequate, you know, suggesting that a child can maintain their connection to culture and identity through visiting an Aboriginal organisation or meeting an Aboriginal footballer. So that's just, it's really unacceptable. And, you know, it's so important for our children to have that connection to their culture, to be strong in their identity, because that builds resilience.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Antoinette. Eddie, really interested to hear, we mentioned briefly that your most recent role has been as the Director of Community Engagement in Darwin for the Royal Commission into the Protection and Detention of Children. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience working for the Royal Commission and working with young people and community? And then secondly, I might ask you if you actually saw a gap between public perceptions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and children in particular in the criminal justice system and the actual reality?
First, just want to acknowledge on country and acknowledge other Aboriginal people in the crowd. Sorry, I can't see anyone. It's not, and all those that work in the area. It's a very difficult area, and working 12 months in the Royal Commission really brought that home, that there's a lot of people working in this space, doing their, you know, doing their best to try and make change. I'll just give a rundown, I suppose. I jotted down some notes to give an overview of the commission and what's happened up until the 12 months that I'd been there. And as pointed out previously, it's been extended till the 17th. The report should be basically given down on the 17th, so that's when it will be with government. So There are 3 months of public hearings in Darwin and Alice Springs covering both youth detention and child protection. And we heard from over 210 witnesses, received more than 480 witness statements and more than 430 personal stories, which can be heard on the webpage if people wanted to hear some of those stories. And a lot of those stories, you know, ain't new stories, that we've all heard them before. So can I just say that as someone who took some of those statements, it really brings it home that, you know, you've heard them before with your own family and even in through, you know, working as a legal officer in an ALS or just even as a discrimination commissioner, that these stories ain't new and the problems ain't new. So let's just make that clear. And as Antoinette pointed out, that it isn't singly just to the Territory. I can tell you that we got heaps of phone calls from all around Australia highlighting the issues that are happening right across the country. We received over 250 submissions. We had site visits to detention centres, and as Charlena pointed out, we've got children in an old men's prison that wasn't suitable then. There's no aircon. Kids are living in less space than between Antoinette and I and the end of the stage. So it's, you know, if you've been in the Territory, the build-up can send you crazy in your own abode. So imagine being in something like that. We visited and engaged with communities, including, with the commissioners and senior council right across the Northern Territory, up the top end and through the centre. The two cyclones held up a bit of that up in the top end, but there were 48 visits, but a lot of those people went back to take statements and follow up with people in regards to some of the issues and concerns people had. And basically, we had private forums and meetings, including with victims of crime, youth justice officers, police officers we spoke with, foster carers, care and protection workers, organisation and peak bodies. We heard hundreds of stories from children, families and communities who had first-hand experience of child protection and detention. And again, we were talking to grandparents who themselves were taken away and now have their grandkids taken away, and some of them had no clue where their grandkids were. So, I mean, this is the sort of investigation that was going on. And as both Charlena and Antoinette pointed out, all the evidence that we were receiving basically said that locking kids up isn't the way to go. And I'm not telling anyone here anything new, but we've had, reports done all over the country in regards to, the Royal Commission in Deaths in Custody is 26 years old. Mick Dodson said at the 25th anniversary that those 339 recommendations are still current today and they probably will be, in this Royal Commission. So, I mean, that's just a summary of where we're at. And in regards to the second question, I think it's a huge value issue going on in this country at the minute. We'd have workers saying a home was suitable, and then we'll have someone else say it's not suitable, and then we have kids taken out of the community, and it's around a value judgment and a lot of times misunderstanding of how Aboriginal communities work. We'd have Aboriginal people working for health and welfare organisations, assisting with other families, but them themselves who had OCA cards for working with children, them themselves couldn't look after their own grandkids or family kids. So there's this, the current chief minister basically said that the system is broken, and so have a lot of other people that work in this space in the Northern Territory say it's broken as well.
And so maybe stepping on from that broken system, Charlena, you briefly mentioned before some of the difficulties that you're seeing with how children are being treated like adults. So what needs to change in the system, you know, particularly for kids to be safe? If they're imprisoned, before they're imprisoned, how do we stop them? That small question.
I'd have to look at the submission I did to the Royal Commission. I think you need to actually look at the evidence of what works, and I don't know if anyone knows too much about the history of certain policies in the Northern Territory, but as a lawyer working on the ground there, a lot of certain laws being changed and policies being implemented were not based on evidence of what works, but very much an idea that came up through a political discussion. So it's not around what the evidence shows of what works in trying to respond to young people who are involved in offending behaviour, and not being based on what the research or evidence tells us around what will work to address the causal factors. So I think that's a real issue, is why not rely on the people who have got the expertise, who and rely on the evidence, and that's to me a real problem. For someone who worked in the youth justice sector for many years, I thought it was crucial that all the key players in the system undertook education, developed specialisation and expertise to actually be able to work within that system, and then to work collaboratively with everyone else who was in the system. And why that is that once you do get that expertise, you understand that, oh, well, that child may well have a disability, or that child seems to be exhibiting the signs or symptoms of fetal alcohol syndrome. You pick that up simply by developing that expertise. You'll understand that that diversion program's available. That's going to be more effective to meet the needs of that young person. Or this young person has needs that require that particular youth support service. Once you develop an expertise, you're going to be more effective in responding to the needs of that child, and you're going to be more effective in addressing the causal factors that led them to offend in the first place and to stop them from reoffending. It was crucial for me, because I was a criminal lawyer doing adult work for so many years, that I undertook this education and developmental process. I had to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a whiz-bang program out there for young lawyers in the Aboriginal Legal Service to become specialised in youth justice. You basically had to self-educate, which I did. But I ensured that I was, as well, educating the staff that I'd built up in my team. We undertook a lot of training and education around trauma, so the impact of trauma on developing child's mind, their behaviours, so you understood what those triggers were if they were starting to act out. And ongoing education, it didn't just stop after doing one course, it was ongoing education and a lot of reading. But I think it's important that all players within the system, police, and there should be a specialised police unit in the Northern Territory that is able to respond to young people who are alleged to have been involved in offending, who are aware of the developmental needs of young people, their differences in cognitive and mental capacity, so that they know, well, that might be the response might be a caution this time, or a warning for that young person, or especially in Aboriginal communities, why are we not engaging community justice groups, Aboriginal elders, people that are going to have some relationship to the child or some potential influence over that child, so that they can learn from their mistakes, so that they're going to be supported to thrive and to develop in appropriately beneficial ways. I think, too, developing the networks and working collaboratively was really important to the work that I did. So I had a very strong relationship that I built up with those officers who were in the youth diversion unit. Anytime there was a barrier, we'd have a meeting. So NAJA goes down, NT Legal Aid went down. Those who administered the youth support service, so Red Cross, Anglicare, we'd convene meetings, and we did it a lot to work out, this is the barrier to this child, how do we overcome that barrier? And so there was ongoing communication, working in collaboration, and breaking down those barriers so more children were able to access diversion. We didn't give up in the advocacy that we did, writing submissions, writing letters, meeting with the ministers, meeting with police, and I think that's the only way. You develop an expertise, you work in collaboration, and you understand what the needs of children are in the system, and you're able to respond appropriately. Otherwise, again, we're just treating children like adults.
Sha, you may kill me for this because this is not a pre-prepared question, but just following on from that, you mentioned like how important these collaborations are and how important it is to be building the relationships and with various players within the system. How do we make sure that those relationships and those collaborations outlast individuals? So when you go and build that relationship, how do we make sure that there's a platform that that relationship continues to exist?
Oh, that's terrible.
I have put you on the spot for that. Feel free to give me an example of what Nadja
Maybe I'll give you the example of the youth court in the Northern Territory. So there's two different youth courts. There's one in Alice Springs, where there's the judges that are based in Alice Springs, and there's judges that are based in Darwin. And the judges in Darwin have chosen to develop an expertise. And they're the judges that I work very closely with in the Darwin Youth Court. What they did was they undertook a substantial amount of self-education. They went to courses, especially around trauma, around childhood development, around educational needs of young people, health needs of young people, especially children who've been exposed to trauma. And they helped educate those in the system. So they'd drag us into... I shouldn't say drag. They invited us into meetings and we'd talk about this. They'd ensure that speakers would come and present. So they were effectively trying to influence others in the sector and vice versa. We would talk to them about certain things that we're doing. Our through care team would come and talk to them around this is what we can offer for young people who are involved, who are in detention, and as a way of trying to support them access programs and services and then allow them to reintegrate in the community with the supports and that they need. So there was always this information sharing, and it was but again, it took people, and I think that's the problem. Again, with the system, you might have legislation, you might have policies, but you really need champions and you need people who have this belief as to what is right in the system, what is going to work in the system. So you need experts, you need champions, and you need to be working collaboratively. And I don't know if you can write that down in any way, because it took the right people. And I don't think it's, you know, because you're going to have not so good people who might not care as much as we do. You might not have people with the sort of skill sets or the values. So again, it's a value-driven type piece of work. So I don't know if that I can really respond to that.
So no, just so something on that. If we just take colour out of it and we look at low socioeconomic, those are the people who are kids who are going to be captured in the juvenile justice system. And I think, you know, Aboriginal groups, we hadn't done it well before. We used to just work amongst each other, but we need our friends to make change. And it's about, you know, educating everyone that what their real issues are and what makes change. Tough on crime, the research is there that says it doesn't work. So, you know, when I was in the role that you're currently in, Carly, that we went and spoke to some non-Indigenous organisations with big, you know, who had members, big memberships and the ability to get to places that Aboriginal people and organisations can't get to. And it's being a lot smarter and advocating to our members and just educating everyone, because no one wants their kid to be in trouble, and every parent tries to do their best. But the reality is, you know, it's just unfortunate that our mob are at the lowest socioeconomic space, and it's our mob that gets captured all the time. You know, 11% of our males are more likely to be in prison. Our women are 24, I think it is, and our kids are 25, 26%. And we only make up 3% of the population. So, you know, there's some huge issues there that systemically that are affecting us at that level, that we dearly need to work with our friends and the community to really educate them that we're not inherently criminals and that we do need you to assist us to make change. And tough on crime, it doesn't help anyone. It actually makes people worse and it costs a whole heap more. So I think that's where we need to really engage with one another, and at times you need to take colour out of it and just think if it was your grandkid or your son or daughter. And I think those, you know, like Change the Record has done that, and the blueprint that it's provided is a great blueprint that we're hoping that it makes Attorney General, state and territory and federally aware that there are better options for them to utilise and save a whole heap of taxpayers' dollars and steer kids away from trouble rather than locking them up at the first sign of issues. I mean, we've all been in some trouble in our time, and me included, and I'm just fortunate enough to not go down that road, and I've had family members or someone to be there for me. So that's how I see that we need to make some changes there, and we really need to think outside the box rather than read what we read in the newspapers or at the 6:30 TV shows.
So, Eddie, you've mentioned about the collaboration, of how important it is, of how important information sharing is, also that we have, Shalina mentioned, champions within the system. And it seems that Change the Record is quite an amazing example of a collaboration between a number of different organisations, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal organisations. But how important is it that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are not only involved in some of the consultations that are occurring around youth justice, but also have decision-making power?
Excuse me. Look, for the last 12 months, that's all I heard from people in remote and urban areas, that, you know, they know there's some they've got some issues, but they also might have answers that they think can make a difference. And what's not happening is we're not engaging with these people and really taking them seriously, that they actually may have an idea on how to make change, because what's been done in the past hasn't worked, and, you know, government's poured heaps and heaps of money into these things that don't work. So, you know, we're talking about traditional people, not so traditional, and non-Indigenous people who kids are in trouble have all said the same thing, that you know, no one's listening, and that government is all about tough on crime. And as Shalina said, you know, we're looking at legislation where mandatory sentencing, presumption of bail is no longer, you know, all these type of things that go against the core of our legal system, which basically means you're guilty till you prove yourself innocent, and you sit on remand for 12 to 18 months, and it's usually you're let out straight away, and we get people pleading guilty to these charges because they know that if they plead guilty, they go straight away, but then they develop a rap that then the next time they come, they're going to get a longer sentence, when in fact they've really done nothing really serious, and this is how the system's working at the moment, and I mean, the money's poured into locking people up rather than diverting kids and in adults as well. And I think that's what we need to really go back to educating our members of Parliament and others that, you know, think differently.
So, Antoinette, we often hear from the federal government that they're not responsible for the over-imprisonment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children or all children. And they say it's because the criminal justice systems are largely the responsibility of the states and territories. Do you think there's a role for the federal government in reducing the rates of our young people in prison?
Absolutely. The federal government has an important role in this. It needs to show some national leadership here. And, you know, Change the Record has been calling for to see justice targets included in the Change the Gap.
Close the Gap
strategy. And, you know, the federal government coordinates responses in many jurisdictions where there's, you know, the common problems and find solutions. So, look, a good example of that is how the federal government has taken leadership in family violence and in health too. So, you know, we want to see some leadership around youth imprisonment. And having the right processes keeps the government accountable. Setting targets will make these processes transparent. And it creates incentives, I guess, for governments to improve and use strategies that are successful. So, yes, it does have a very key role and it would be fantastic to see some national leadership on this issue.
Mm. And I might throw this question open to the entire panel. The audience has heard essentially that we have had countless reports, recommendations, inquiries relating to inducing the over-imprisonment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We've also heard that this is not isolated to the Northern Territory. There is abuse and imprisonment of young people occurring right around the country. So how do we ensure then that the report of the Royal Commission in the Northern Territory, once it's released in November, that the recommendations are actually implemented, one, by the Northern Territory government, but how do we ensure that we can make use of those recommendations in the report right around the country?
So whilst working on the Royal Commission, we spoke heavily about the reports that have come before, particularly, the deaths in custody. I mean, the most recent that top of my head is Doing Time for Doing for Juvenile Justice. It's a great report. But it just seems that they get put out there but nothing happens. And I think there's a responsibility by government, but also I think there's a responsibility by our organisations and our community to really be more prevalent in pushing that our members do something about these reports. We've got these senators cruising around the country doing all these reports and government's ignoring their own reports. So I think, it's our responsibility as well as community people to make sure that, keep our members honest and making sure that something's been done and continually put that pressure on them, because in the past, we don't even follow up on them. And again, I point to the deaths in custody. That report wasn't just on deaths in custody. It went right across the sphere of education, housing, child protection, everything. So I think, there's a responsibility by government, but also that we need to put our hands up as well as community members that we have a responsibility to make sure that we, push that some of these reports and advocate, even at the lowest level, it can make some change. If it makes your neighbour think differently, well, that's a start.
The national leadership, I'm part of the Redfern Statement, and we've been, calling on the government to ensure that Aboriginal people are driving change, that we make decisions, that we do have the solutions within our communities. So it is the higher level advocacy, and it's about government acknowledging also that this issue is national, and us keeping government accountable.
I just support everything they say, but I think the humanity of a community is often reflected in how we treat our children. So children are all of our responsibilities, and I think, as Eddie said, we need to hold government to account. We need to be advocating around the findings, around the recommendations, and to keep putting pressure on change that's going to be evidence-based and effective. Otherwise, we're going to continue to be harming our children. And I'm sick of reading report after report and repeating those recommendations from past reports. The evidence is there. The solutions are easily available. It just takes political will.
On that note, with ending with children are the responsibility of the whole community, I'm going to throw it over to you as our community here tonight to ask the panellists some questions.
Hi, thanks for that. That was really fantastic. I just wanted to ask, I spent a little bit of time up in the Northern Territory working as a lawyer and legal educator in Alice Springs, working with people with children in detention and also with bush mob. It seemed to me that many of those children had a similar, or many, but not all, had a similar story of being exposed to violence, alcohol abuse, sexual abuse at home by family members. And that had led, or at least partially contributed to subsequent offending and, yeah, and a downward spiral in their particular lives. In terms of discussing fixing or moving towards better systems, what part does talking specifically about families and the role that parents and extended family members play in fixing that system, what kind of discussion is being taken place around that particular issue, and what role of that particular issue is there in that broader discussion without, of course, alienating particular people or families whilst talking about those particular issues?
So, panellists, I think questions sort of largely along the lines of what role are families and extended families playing in trying to reduce the over-imprisonment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people without stigmatising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? Is that a fair reflection of your question?
Maybe I'll just give an example. So when I was working at NAJA, our CLE team were involved in helping the Kutadji, I think it was the Kutadji, it was either the Kutadji or the Bunawara, so the community justice group, which is a coalition of elders in the community, to provide a joint statement, so evidence to support a case to keep the child with extended family rather than to be taken into child protection. And what I understood the background was the child protection worker had not spoken to the extended family. The concept of family had been quite nuclear in the sense of mum, dad and brothers and sisters, but not talking to grandpa, uncles and aunties that were all considered mum and dad to that child. But the elders had said, we want to talk, we want to tell that the court in this child protection proceedings that we have the solutions, we know what the risks are, and we're going to be able to address that if you listen to us. So it was the most powerful piece of collaborative work where family, community and people who had a responsibility to that child actually said, we know the dangers of the system, we've seen too many of us taken away, and some of them had also been taken away as children, that they were able to show the court that there's a support network here, that we're going to be able to address the risk, and these are the ways we're going to do it. And it was effective in keeping that child with the family and with the community. And, of course, with supports were in place that could be appropriately monitored in case something went awry. So I thought that was a good example of where community and family understood that kid was in danger. There were worse things that were causing harm to that child and we needed to take action. But they did it in a way, even though the system is not really geared to helping Aboriginal people and community to have a say, they were able to do it through this other mechanism. And I thought that was a good example how you need to include not just the nuclear family, you need to include people who have responsibility, especially in Aboriginal way, so that they can play a role in helping that child and helping that child to thrive. Does that help try to answer that question?
And both of those groups that you spoke at the hearing and said that they have the ability. They understand the politics internally, what's going on, and they, because of ceremony and kinship connection, they can move family within family like 500, 600 kilometres away, and that kid will still, or child will still have the cultural values and connection around it till you know the matter's resolved or what have you. And what they were saying was that they just want to have the ability to be involved in that decision making, and if that work towards making sure that those kids still have the ability to learn about their other responsibility about caring for country, culture, language, and but they're also aware of what the harm that was involved within that community for that individual. So Again, people want to, they know that there's some issues, but they want to be involved in the decision making around what's the best procedures for that child, and what's happened. And I suppose I didn't mention this previously, but in the Northern Territory, for example, they're saying since the intervention and the shires, the whole engagement with Aboriginal people has demised, and which has caused a lot of people leaving country and homeless in urban centres, and causing other dramas as well. So there's a whole issue in regards to policy that's been made on the run, and I hope that sort of answers your question in regards to what's available within communities, and also again diversion and other programs that aren't being funded properly, you know, pilots and that just don't assist the overall allowing to have kids diverted or put in to a safe place as well.
We might head to the next question. Antoinette, did you want to jump in?
I just wanted to just make a few comments on that, you know, that just in terms of breaking down the stigma, like there can't be a one-size-fits-all approach. Like our communities and our people are just so diverse. And, for example, you know, my area is family violence. You know, most of the work we do is with Aboriginal women. And often when I talk about violence against Aboriginal women, people's mind goes straight to, this is an Aboriginal man hurting that woman, and that's not the case. For example, in metropolitan Melbourne, 85% of Aboriginal women who live here in metropolitan Melbourne are partnered with a non-Indigenous person. But, you know, we've still got children that are Aboriginal, and so all of the programs that we develop and deliver here in Melbourne are very different to, you know, what might happen in a remote or a rural community. And you can't underestimate the work of Aboriginal community-controlled organisations in developing and delivering early intervention prevention to our people.
Mm. Yeah. Do we have another question for the panellists?
Thank you for allowing me to walk on your land and being here tonight. I'm not sure if you're aware, up in Townsville, the Cleveland Detention Centre there was even worse than Dundale. And the Aboriginal elders have been getting together there. In fact, I'm the guy that had this dream, and it's starting to come true. They're getting, got funding for it. They are going to take the Aboriginal young people into the bush and teach them all the stuff they used to learn when they have initiation ceremonies. And I think too, like a long time ago, I had no self-esteem, and until I read a book by Louise Hay, You Can Heal Your Life, I learnt to love myself. I had to say it over and over and over again to learn to love myself. And I think, you know, the way the white people have been treated Aboriginals as second-class citizens, I think they need to be start being put up on pedestals that you've got, you're the oldest living culture in this world, you're an absolutely fantastic culture. And, yeah, take care. So, and I just want to know too, is the Koori Court still running here in Melbourne?
Yes, it is. I might take that one fairly quickly, and thank you for that comment. We'll take it as a comment and maybe ask if there's one more question from the audience.
I was wondering whether government incentives to make sure that there was far more Indigenous police officers, whether that would help in any way for communities and rural areas.
I don't believe that more police will help.
More teachers would. More Aboriginal
what
teachers.
Needs to happen is an investment into Aboriginal community-controlled organisations, you know, to address those underlying issues. The solutions lie within Aboriginal community organisations. A few years ago, under the Women's Safety Package, you know, we saw that there was a huge investment into more police into remote communities to address family violence, and that's just not going to work, you know. Violence is so underreported. There's a lack of trust. within the system. We do not need more police.
Another question.
We do, even Indigenous police, we don't need Indigenous police.
No.
We need Indigenous lawyers.
No, I said teachers.
And magistrates and judges.
Teachers.
Teachers, definitely teachers. I'll just tap onto the teacher thing. Every child, I shouldn't say every child, but the vast majority of children that I dealt with in the youth justice system were not in school and hadn't been in school for months, if not years. So there's a clear trigger there, and I would have thought that's a red flag. So if we're going to, in some way, have a difference in stopping the trajectory of children going into youth justice and prisons in Australia, then it's about trying to invest in keeping children in schools. They belong in schools, not prisons.
And teach real history in
the curriculum. And teach real history.
So that'll go a long way in changing mindsets.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask if you think there's anything that we as individuals can actually do going away from this, taking what you've said away and acting to put pressure on the people who are making the decisions. For example, taking the money away from the Cherry Creek new youth prison in Victoria and putting it towards the organisations that you're talking about supporting, the Aboriginal controlled organisations.
Absolutely. Advocate for an investment into Aboriginal community control, because our children do not belong in prisons.
No kid belongs in prison, and I think that's the message that should be, that every kid deserves a chance.
I've just seen so much damage and harm come out of kids who've been in youth prisons. So there's just no way a child should be in youth prison, and we should be doing everything we can to look at ways of diverting them out, dealing with them in alternative measures that actually help them learn from their mistakes and actually deal with the causal factors that led them to offend in the first place. There are so many mechanisms out there, including warnings, cautions, youth diversion programs that actually help the young person. Victim offender conferencing, run by some of the youth support services around Australia, are so effective in helping a child learn from their mistakes, deal with any risk factors, so drug and alcohol counselling, family support services. That's what we should be investing in. And they're just so much more effective. Diversion is by far the most effective way of dealing with youth offending. And the evidence is there. I just, like, New Zealand, 80% of children are diverted out. Why do we keep relying on an adult-centred system that's ineffective when we can be looking at systems which are effective, responsive, and have an evidence base?
I would go back one step before that and just say prevention. Because then we don't need diversion.
Yeah.
And perhaps if people want more information too, like, you can look on Family Violence's website, you can look on the Human Rights Law Centre's website, you can look at Change the Record, NATSL's. There's a number of publications and recommendations that are on each of those websites. And I encourage you, you know, as Shalina said, this is your community and you have a responsibility. And if you feel strongly about something, write to your local member, go and volunteer at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community controlled organisations, and maybe change the language of the way that we talk about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, because there are a hell of a lot of kids who are thriving. Can I please get a round of applause for the three panellists tonight for sharing their expertise and their stories.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.